Welcome, everybody, to the October edition of the McFarland's HR podcast. I'm Matthew Ramsey. I'm the senior knowledge lawyer in the employment team here. And I'm joined this month by our very special guest, who is Jason Galbraith-Martin, King's Counsel. Jason needs very little introduction to anyone who's paid any attention at all to the employment law world over the last few years. He comes fresh from the Supreme Court, where he's victorious once again, having been victorious in the seminal Uber decision a little while ago. He's now been back to his victorious ways in a case called Agnew against the Chief Constable of Northern Ireland, which is all about working time and holiday pay. Hello, Jason, and thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks very much for inviting me along.
So I said that this was a Northern Ireland police case. Why are we interested in it?
Well, we're interested in it, I think, for two reasons. There's an interesting point on the procedural rules attaching to claims brought under the working time regulations. Of particular relevance to police officers in Northern Ireland, because they're deemed to be workers for the purposes of their working time regulations, but they're not workers for the purposes of the Employment Rights Order, their equivalent of the Employment Rights Act. And it's not obviously not just police officers that fall into that position, may not be able to claim under the 1996 Act. So there's that procedural provision that's very interesting. We'll come back and say a bit more about that, I'm sure. But the other point, and the one that I think most people in Great Britain have been talking about, certainly, is that in Agnew, the Supreme Court has effectively overruled the decision of Mr. Justice Langstaff in the Bear Scotland case to the effect that a three-month gap between a series of deductions necessarily breaks that series and acts as a sort of backstop on how far back individuals can go. So the Supreme Court has said that is wrong. So those are the two main points that came out of it.
So let's just sort of unpack those and perhaps provide listeners with a tiny bit more background. So my recollection of holiday pay is that the ECJ over many years has commanded employers to pay what they term normal remuneration, which isn't necessarily the same as basic salary, for any period of annual paid holiday. And as you say, that the Bear Scotland decision made the calculation of how quickly somebody needed to act to bring claims very complicated. Can you just remind me that there are two different ways, aren't there, of litigating holiday pay underpayments or shortfalls?
Yeah, there are. So you're quite right. The EU, the Williams case and the Locke case that people may well have heard of, have been applied in the UK, ironically enough, by Mr. Justice Langstaff in the bit of Bear Scotland that the Supreme Court agreed with, have been applied in the UK to mean that for the purposes of EU leave, that's the four-week period of leave mandated by the Working Time Directive, you must receive your normal remuneration, and that will generally include compulsory and regularly worked overtime commission payments of that kind. Whereas under the domestic law, it had previously been held that an employer could get away with paying only basic pay for holiday pay. And indeed, for the 1.6 weeks of additional pay, there's no legal requirement to take into account overtime and commission. You can still pay just basic pay. But for that four-week period of EU leave, it's got to be normal pay. And of course, under the working time regulations themselves, there is a mechanism to bring a claim. So where you're not paid in accordance with your entitlement, you can bring a claim under the working time regulations. But it has also been established that if I fail to pay you the amount of holiday pay to which you are entitled, I am making an unlawful deduction from your pay. So in parallel with your right to bring a claim under the working time regulations, you can bring a claim under the unlawful deduction provisions of the Employment Rights Order in Northern Ireland or the Employment Rights Act in Great Britain. You can, in fact, also bring it as a breach of contract claim. So you could in theory bring it in the civil courts, but obviously it's much cheaper and simpler and quicker to bring it as an unlawful deduction claim in the employment tribunal.
Okay, so there are three different potential avenues to have your day in court. And presumably each of those carries with it its own bespoke timing arrangement.
Well, the significant difference between them is that whilst both are subject to a usual three-month limitation period, so you've got to present a claim within 3 months of the payment that contained the underpayment of holiday pay. Under the unlawful deduction provisions of the Employment Rights Act, there is the additional ability to bring a claim in respect of a series of deductions. So if there is a series of deductions, you can go back further than just 3 months. And in fact, in Great Britain, you can go back as long as 2 years. There's a two-year backstop, so up to 2 years worth of back payments. Interestingly, in Northern Ireland, they don't have the two-year backstop. So their unlawful deduction provision does not contain the Section 4A that was introduced in, I think it was 2014 now, to the Employment Rights Act. So one of the interesting features of the Agnew case is that the successful claimants in that case can claim potentially as far back as 1998, when the working time regulations were introduced there. There's actually a potential to go back to 1996, because the UK government was required to implement the working time directive by 1996 and didn't, only implemented in 1998. So there's an argument yet to be had about whether they can go back as far as 96. So that's under the Employment Rights Act provision. You can bring a series of deduction claim. You can't do that under the working time regulations. You can only effectively go back 3 months.
Got it. Okay. So that brings us neatly to your first, the first point that you made a moment ago when you were introducing the Agnew decision, and this point about EU equivalence and reading words in to make, to enable people who could bring one of those types of claim but couldn't bring the other. I got very lost when I was reading the judgment. You're cleverer than I am. So can you explain the principle of equivalence in sort of a short, a tidy way?
I can't claim all the credit for it, because it was in fact the decision of the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal. So the Supreme Court's upheld the decision of the Northern Ireland Supreme Court. It wasn't my invention. But the principle of equivalence means that the procedural rules attaching to the exercise of a right that derives from EU law cannot be any less favourable than the procedural conditions attaching to an equivalent domestic right. And effectively, what the Supreme Court held was that the right to bring a claim in respect of underpayment of holiday pay under the working time regulations was equivalent to the right to claim for unlawful deductions under the Employment Rights Act. And therefore, the procedural rules attaching to the working time claim had to be no less favourable than the procedural rules attaching to the unlawful deduction claim. So that meant you had to import into the working time regulations the right to bring a claim in respect of a series of deductions.
Okay, and that was important here because the claimants in this case, well, I appreciate there were some civilian staff, but most of the claimants were police officers who weren't employees or workers for the purposes of the employment rights order.
I mean, it's interesting, and I think this is one of the points that might have influenced the justices. So the claimants are both police officers and civilian employees of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. The civilian employees are, of course, entitled to bring claims in respect of a series of deductions under the Employment Rights Act equivalent in Northern Ireland. And it just seemed manifestly unfair that you've got individuals often might be working side by side, obviously not doing exactly the same job, often working side by side. And the respondents accepted that this cohort could go back potentially as far as 98, relying on a series of deductions, but said the police officers couldn't. And I think that unfairness may well have influenced.
Yeah, that's so, a pretty unattractive position to start from, isn't it, as an employer?
It is, yeah. Some are going to get it and some aren't. And of course, the other thing just worth pointing out, that those that work for the police service in Northern Ireland for many years have worked significant amounts of overtime for probably obvious reasons. And so These are very valuable claims to them.
Understood. And so the meat of the decision from a general sort of GB UK-wide perspective is this question of what counts as a series. And, you know, as a sort of a general rule of English, you'd expect if I make a payment to my builder once every 6 months, isn't that still a series, even though there are long gaps between it? Or why was this sort of 3 month period fixed on by the Bear Scotland decision?
So this is the bit of the case or a bit of the case that the Supreme Court upheld. This is a bit of the Bear Scotland case that the Supreme Court upheld. You're quite right to say that whether payments are or form part of a series, it's largely a question of fact in each case. Is there sufficient similarity between them, both in terms of the nature of the payments and potentially in terms of the temporal element, how far apart they're spaced, to mean that they can form part of a series? And effectively what the Supreme Court has said is there's no bright line as far as that is concerned. Each case will very much depend on its own merits. You might have an individual, for example, who's paid annual commission or an annual bonus, and there's a deduction made from the bonus every year. So the gap is 12 months, but nonetheless, it can form part of a series. Is there an underlying vice, is the rather nice phrase that the Supreme Court came up with to describe or explain why there has been an unlawful deduction, an underpayment? Why did Mr. Justice Langstaff say that a period of 3 months would break the gap? Well, he relied on the fact that there's a three-month limitation period for the presentation of a claim. So he said, obviously, if 3 months go by, generally speaking, you lose your right to claim. And it would be a little bit odd if that right revived simply because there's another deduction that occurs more than 3 months later.
Isn't that the whole point of the series concept?
Well, that's exactly what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court said that the series concept is to deal with precisely that situation. And it pointed out how unfair and impractical it could be to require employees to present multiple claims just to avoid the passage of 3 months. So if you take your holidays at Christmas and then you skip Easter and then take another holiday in the summer, you should be able to present a claim in respect of an underpayment for both of those periods of holiday without having to present a claim after Christmas, a claim after summer, and do that every year. I was going to say one of the things it relied on is the fact that employees are often reluctant to litigate against their employer, again, for wholly obvious reasons. There might come a point where you say enough's enough and you finally want to bring a claim, but entirely understandable that you might not want to do so, you know, in your first year of employment or second year of employment or whilst you're still there and hoping to get promotion, etc. And again, one of the points that the Supreme Court made in Agnew, reiterating what had been said in Uber, is you've got to bear in mind the purpose behind this legislation. It is to protect often vulnerable employees, and the most vulnerable are the ones that are least likely to pipe up and say, I think I made more money.
Yeah, that must be right as a sort of a general rule. And the other mischief, I guess, that certainly some employers, some sort of slightly dubious employers have contemplated over the years, is trying to sort of game the system by making one accurate holiday payment every now and again to try to break the concept of a series. Is that a runnable solution?
So, I mean, it's not just those. I'm sure there are some that are trying to game the system, but not everyone will be trying to game the system. Remember, right at the start, we talked about the four-week period of EU leave and then the 1.6 weeks of additional leave. And you can pay lawfully, basic pay, not including overtime, etc., in respect of the 1.6 weeks. So if in any year someone takes 5.6 weeks of holiday, it would necessarily follow that if they were only paid basic pay throughout, they'd been underpaid for 4 weeks of that holiday, but at least 1.6 weeks of it would have been a lawful payment. So one of the issues in the case was, does it matter in which order you take your EU and your additional leave? And I think both parties here were trying to manipulate to see how we could come up with an answer that was most favourable to us. It obviously suited the other side to say, well, you must take all your EU leave in one go, and then you take your additional leave at the end, and that effectively breaks the chain so that the next time you take EU leave, you can't link it to the former block of 4 weeks. The Supreme Court was unimpressed by that. So it held that, again, it's largely a question of fact. You need to look at the underlying reason why there's been an underpayment. And in this case, The reason why there'd been an underpayment was because of a failure to properly calculate the amounts due for EU leave. The fact that you were lawfully paid in respect of your additional leave was neither here nor there. It couldn't break the chain because the underlying vice didn't apply to it. It wasn't EU leave. So it follows that simply making a lawful payment will not necessarily break the chain. But one interesting thing that came out of that, and it actually links to what the Conservative government has recently put out a consultation on, is whether we should continue to distinguish between EU leave and additional leave. And it's proposed actually doing away with that two-tier approach and just having a single description in respect of leave. And the Supreme Court in Agnew did say that leave should be treated as a single composite pot. So employees nor employers are required to identify whenever someone takes their leave, whether they're taking EU leave or they're taking additional leave. It all comes out of a single pot. And that makes a lot of practical sense, but it also raises perhaps more questions than it answers. Because, of course, as the law currently stands, you do have to pay differently in respect of EU leave and additional leave. 1,000 employers to know what they're supposed to pay. And in fact, someone has already asked me the question, if it's a composite pot of holiday, can we work out a composite rate of payment? Now, putting aside the administrative difficulties associated with that, I think there's a superficial attractiveness to it. Yes, you know, we can do away with having to distinguish between different types of holiday. But I think the real problem is a composite pot is effectively an average of the two rates of pay, weighted slightly towards EU leave, obviously, because it's a longer period. But if it's an average rate of pay, it's going to be less than the rate required for EU leave. So if someone does only take 4 weeks leave a year, or even someone who takes first 2 weeks of their leave, if they're paid at that composite rate, they might turn around and say, well, hang on, that's my EU leave, thank you very much, and I want it paid at the higher rate. You've underpaid me by only paying at a composite rate. So as I say, potentially raises more questions than it answers on that point.
Does that concept of a composite pot apply to those employees who are lucky enough to have a contractual element on top of the statutory, the two different sections of statutory leave?
So I think it probably does. I mean, interestingly, police officers in Northern Ireland, not the civilian employees, but the police officers also get a couple of extra days contractual leave. There wasn't any discussion about that in the case. It didn't feature, but we effectively treated it the same as the additional leave. So when we were having arguments, for example, about whether they were being properly paid in respect of additional leave, I think it was implicit in that that the PSNI were arguing that the contractual leave paid at basic pay only was also a lawful payment and was another way in which the series might be broken. So although it's not expressly dealt with, I think by implication, the same argument would apply to it.
Because most employment contracts, as far as I can gather, just say, you know, you're entitled to 30 days holiday, let's say, per year. And they don't distinguish on the face of the drafting between the EU element, the other UK statutory element, and the contractual element. And so I guess if you don't spell it out in the contract, then presumably should an employer assume that all that leave should be paid, taking into account overtime and commission, those other elements?
Well, so one of the government's questions in the consultation is, if we do have just a single type of leave, should it all be paid at the higher rate? Or, now that they can, should it all be paid at the lower rate? Obviously, now that we're no longer in the EU and post-January next year, they would be entitled to depart from EU law if they chose to. So there's always a possibility that the government will make that decision for us by saying it all ought to be at the higher rate, or it can all be at the lower rate. But presently, and of course, I should just say that will be the consultation will close at a certain point, and they'll have to formulate proposals, and then they'll have to think about whether they can get them through before the next general election. So who knows what will happen on that front. But so back to the question you asked, what's an employer to do? I think this is a really difficult question, because as the law currently stands, you know, it does only apply to employees who are being paid commission who are working either compulsory or regular overtime. Won't apply, I'm sure, to many employees. But for those to whom this does apply, employers are required, legally required, to pay at the higher rate, normal pay, in respect to 4 weeks, and can, if they choose, pay at the lower rate for the 1.6. They don't have a choice about the higher rate as the law currently stands. So they could decide to pay for all leave at the higher rate, but they can't currently decide to pay for all of it at the lower rate.
I was looking at another bit of drafting a couple of weeks ago, where the contract tried to set out the order in which leave was taken to sort of mirror that sequential approach that Mr. Justice Langethoff adopted. Do you think that's viable any longer?
There was no point about that taken in the Supreme Court because it didn't apply to the conditions of employment that we were concerned with. I have to say that I think you must be free to contract on that basis. So the composite pot argument, I think, only works because absent a contractual term to that effect, it is difficult to distinguish between what might be EU leave and what might be additional leave. But if the contract in an effective way does distinguish between the two, and it could, for example, say, the first 4 weeks are necessarily EU leave, or it might say, all your holidays EU leave apart from the bank holidays. Your bank holidays are additional leave. Remember, the 8 days were originally introduced by the Labour government to reflect the fact that employers have been taking bank holidays out of that period of 4 weeks leave. So it could do something like that to try and make it clear. And if it does so, then I think we can lose the composite pot argument. So I think that's a default position, composite pot, where the contract doesn't sufficiently distinguish between it.
Interesting. And so you mentioned right at the beginning that the right under the Employment Rights Act, Employment Rights Order in Northern Ireland, was to recover a maximum of 2 years of underpayments. I remember when that was introduced and lots of people were up in arms about the idea that there should be any limit on recovery. And as you said, it doesn't apply in Northern Ireland anyway. Is that limit here to stay? We've talked before about it being open to challenge.
You probably remember that at the time that two-year limit was introduced, it was roughly the time that Bear Scotland came out. And thinking at the time was that if employers were going to face claims for underpayments of holiday pay that were unlimited, it might bankrupt many employers. This was going to be a huge cost to business. And it was very much felt at the time that Mr. Justice Langstaff introducing that three-month break was a sort of judicial way of limiting that potential scenario. And the government had a go too by introducing the two-year backstop. So both of them concerned to achieve much the same sort of objective. Certainly that's what people were saying at the time. One quick point, you asked me about this when we spoke a while ago, which is that the effect of the decision of the Supreme Court is not to allow police officers to bring claims under the Employment Rights Act. They still bring their claims under the working time regulations, but you must import into the working time regulations the more favourable series of deductions provision from the Employment Rights Order, the Employment Rights Act. And you raised an interesting question. Okay, so they can now bring a claim in respect of a series of deductions under the working time regulations. That two-year limitation doesn't appear in the working time regulations. So does that mean everyone can simply bring their claims under the working time regulations and effectively sidestep the two-year limitation? Brilliant though that is, I think that's unlikely to happen because the principle of equivalence makes it clear that the procedural rules in respect of an EU-derived right can be no less favourable than an equivalent domestic right. But EU law does not require you to introduce your most favourable rules in relation to EU-derived rights. So I think that if anyone brought a claim under the working time regulations seeking to rely on Agnew, they'd be met with an argument, well, yes, you can read in the bit of the Employment Rights Act that allows you to claim in respect to the series, but you've also got to read in the bit that says you can't go back further than 2 years. So I don't think the sidestepping works. Is the two-year limitation period itself vulnerable to challenge? People have been saying this ever since it came in, but here we are nearly a decade later, and no challenge that I'm aware of has been brought, certainly not a successful challenge. But there are rumblings, aren't there, afoot There are various ways in which you can challenge it. I think under EU law, it could be said that if you limit someone to a period of 2 years, you are artificially cutting off their loss, and therefore you're depriving them of an effective remedy. You might remember Mrs. Marshall, I think, brought the claim, Marshall and Southampton, because she was only allowed to go back 2 years in respect of an equal pay claim. And the European court held that artificial limit of 2 years not applying to anything else contrary to EU law. So there's an attractive similarity to a challenge based on EU law. I think the reality is you're not going to be able to bring that challenge after the 1st of January next year, or you may not be able to bring that challenge after the 1st of January next year. So I don't know whether that one will run. But I've seen a couple of other quite novel and interesting arguments being raised. One is that your accrued right to holiday pay is a property right, and therefore to deprive you of the right to go back as far as you've suffered loss would be an unlawful interference with your rights enshrined by the first article to the first protocol to the European Convention on Human Rights. Someone's running that point against me. I have to say, I ran that same point in Agnew. So if I hadn't have won on the principle of equivalence, I was running exactly that same point. But the Supreme Court didn't need to hear from me on that point because they were in our favour on the principle of equivalence. So I think there is legs in that argument. That, of course, because it's European Convention of Human Rights, it's not EU law. And if people,
yes,
not lawyers, of course, but those who aren't trained often think that because we've left the EU, you can't rely on European Convention law anymore. But of course, they're completely different. So that would run whatever happens in relation to retained EU law.
Yeah. So I guess then the takeaways for most listeners then will be that for the moment, the 2 year limit on recovery survives and caps liability, breaks in a series don't necessarily mean that it isn't a series,
exactly,
and it's still hard to decide precisely which day, what sort of leave each day's holiday happens to be.
Yes, that knotty problem hasn't gone away. It might do following the consultation exercise. Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair summary. I think those that are sort of acting for employers shouldn't be too disheartened by this, because you quite rightly pointed out the decision of the Supreme Court means that a gap of 3 months doesn't necessarily break a series, but it doesn't rule out the possibility that a break of 3 months or less might break a series, because it's now very much a question of fact. What is it you're complaining about? What's the underlying description or explanation said to give rise to a series? And it may well be, for example, that if someone's short pay changed their commission on a fairly regular basis, but then complains about a different sort of incentive payment and brings a complaint within 3 months of the non-payment of that incentive or the shortfall in that incentive payment, you could say, oh, yes, but that's a very different payment from the bonus or the commission payments you were getting, and therefore it's not a series. So it's not all bad news for employers.
I can feel a lot of interesting emails in which I am required to look at underlying vice.
Yeah. Underlying vice, yes,
absolutely. And I should probably tell my IT department to allow vice through the firewall.
Be careful what you type into the search.
Absolutely. Yeah. Smashing. Well, on that lighthearted note, Jason, it just remains for me to say a massive thank you for your very wise thoughts on this interesting case.
Great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me along.
That's it for this month. We will return in November. Many thanks for listening. And if you need anything in relation to holiday pay or anything else, Jason and my details will appear in the episode description. Many thanks.